Album released in 2001 called God Bless the Blake Babies. Blake Babies would disappear. Now, the Blake Babies actually disbanded in 1992, and Juliana Hatfield went off on a solo career. John and Frieda started their own band called Antenna into the 1990s, and then in 1999, they got back together, did a few shows together, and started doing some recordings, and the result was this 2001 album called God Bless the Blake Babies. Before that, though, it was from that Rosie Jack World EP from 1991, Grassroots Temptation Eyes. I do want to remind you again that you can tune into my regular show, Viva Lamach, Friday nights at 9 p.m. here on WRCT. Speaking of shows, have you checked out the Deep Blues Hour? Yeah, it's an hour of classic and traditional blues music, but no, it's better than that, because it's actually 3 hours of the Deep Blues Hour with Steve every Tuesday night from 7 until 10 p.m. That's right, 3 hours of classic and traditional blues right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I got one more Blake Babies song to wrap up this Blake Babies block of music for you, and I'm going back to my favorite Blake Babies song. It comes off the Sunburned album. It's Girl in a Box here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
I've got a girl in a box. Keep her under my bed. Sure must get hot in the summertime. I get her out. There's nothing else to do. And there's nothing on TV when I can't see you. Wife don't mind if I give her a child. My wife don't mind. She thinks it's pretty wild. I've got this girl in a box. I got a girl in a box. I'll keep her till the day. I'll keep her till the day. I'll keep her till the day that I die. And I hope I die with my TV on and a beer in my hand, and you by my side. I got a girl in a box. We play games. I'm anything I'm not, but I wanna be. Yeah, I wanna be. She'll be a slut, a dirty little whore, or the girl next door, or my bride instead, or I'll cut off her head if I want to. Yeah, I want to. I'll keep her till the
box. Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Well, everybody, it's really incredible. I decide, hey, you know what? It'd be a great thing to take a break from dealing with a newborn baby and do a show. I check out what's been happening at the Trump riot hearings, and the big headline is big, massive dumps, as if that's not what I've already been dealing with at home. Incredible second day in the Trump riot hearings. Now, of course, many of you are already familiar with this entire dumps thing.
Dumps.
Yeah, you guys remember that, right?
Big, massive dumps.
Sure. Well, yesterday at the Trump riot hearings, they actually played the video. Big, massive dumps trends on Twitter after January 6th committee airs infamous Trump interview with Maria Bartiromo. Big, massive dumps have gone completely mainstream, dominating yesterday's second day of the Trump riot hearings. And my audience, of course, knows about it. This is the original. This was sort of setting the stage for explaining the different elements of Donald Trump's campaign to steal the election. For those who may not remember, this is that critical moment in American political history. Big, massive dumps.
And what happened, if you watched the election, I was called by the biggest people.
People.
Saying, congratulations, political people. Congratulations, sir, you just won the election. It was 10 o'clock and you looked at the numbers and I'm sure you felt that way.
Sure.
This election was over. And then they did dumps. They call them dumps, big, massive dumps in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And all over.
Okay, so that is one aspect of all of the not only unproven, but debunked conspiracy theories about the election. And we're going to get into more specific claims that the January 6th committee did a really good job of saying, here's the claim. Here's someone who knows saying it's bogus. And this is Republicans mostly presenting this testimony, which we will get to. But one other aspect in general of thinking about the January 6th riots is, was Trump a factor in the people that were rioting being there rioting? In other words, were they there because of something that Donald Trump said? And the January 6th committee closed yesterday's hearing with a video of exactly that, of Trump supporters saying they were there because of the things Trump said, including that there were, excuse the term, massive dumps. Take a listen to this.
I know exactly what's going on right now. Fake election. They think they're going to shoot us out of our vote and put Congress Biden in office. It ain't happening today, but
you voted?
Yes, sir.
How did it go?
Voted early. It went well, except for the can't really trust the software. Dominion software all over.
We voted, and right in the top right-hand corner of the Dominion voting machine that we used, there was a Wi-Fi symbol with five bars.
Uh-oh.
So that most definitely connected to the internet, without a doubt. So they stole that from us twice. We're not doing it anymore. We're not taking it anymore. So we're standing up, we're here, and whatever happens, we're not laying down again.
It didn't work. It didn't work. No.
Trust the system.
200,000 people that weren't even registered voted. 430,000 votes disappeared from President Trump's tally. And you can't stand there and tell me that it worked.
I don't want to say that what we're doing is right. But if the election is being stolen, what is it going to take?
Okay, so of an individual coughing a lot. Those are all specific claims being made by Trump and people around him. So that's the sort of broader context for yesterday's hearings. Let's now get into some of the specific claims. Every central claim about the 2020 election made by failed former President Donald Trump and the people around him, including people like Mark Meadows, but also wackier people like Sidney Powell, Mike Pillow Lindell, and others. Every single one of those claims was systematically contradicted and debunked by mostly Republican testimony, as we saw during yesterday's second day of the Trump riot hearings. I'm going to give you some examples here, and you will see how comprehensively every single one of these claims is easily refuted. Former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, a Republican, said there is no evidence of even 8 dead people voting, never mind the 8,000 dead voters that Trump and people around him claimed.
In the claim that dead people were voting. In fact, Mr. Giuliani told Pennsylvania state legislators that 8,000 dead people voted in Pennsylvania. You investigated those claims of voter fraud. Can you tell us what you found?
Not only was there not evidence of 8,000 dead voters voting in Pennsylvania, there wasn't evidence of 8. We took seriously every case that was referred to us, no matter how fantastical, no matter how absurd, and took every one of those seriously, including these.
So it's not that they say, well, you have to investigate all of it. It was investigated. You just don't like the outcome of that investigation. And dead voters, that's one bucket of claims. We've looked into it extensively. There was an investigation, I believe it was in Michigan, where they started with a list of I believe it was 10,000 supposedly dead voters. I believe it was The Guardian, if not the BBC. They said, let's randomly choose. I think it was 35 of the 1,000 or 2,000, whatever. Let's investigate them. And then with those 35, they found most of them, there was evidence that the people were alive. Like, there was just really no reason to think that they were dead. In a few cases, it was people who were indeed alive at the time that they voted. And then when they mailed in their ballot, then they died. Nothing illegal there. In some cases, there was like junior, senior confusion. I mean, it was all just picked apart. Next claim, Georgia smuggled ballots. Former acting deputy attorney general testifies that he personally investigated the Georgia smuggled ballots, found nothing, told him it was false, but it didn't matter.
To play again a testimony from Mr. Donahue, who appeared before the committee before today.
Mr. Donahue, we talked at some length about whether or not the White House or the president was informed about the Antrim report. On the results of the investigations, the interviews that had gone on Fulton County, how would those results have been communicated to the White House, to the president?
I don't know how they were initially communicated. I do know that they came up in subsequent conversations with the president, and Dad Rose and I essentially told him, we looked into that, and it's just not true.
Okay, so he was informed.
I told the president myself that several times in several conversations, that these allegations about ballots being smuggled in a suitcase and run through the machine several times, it was not true. That we looked at the video, we interviewed the witnesses, it was not true.
Right.
We're doing a class action lawsuit against all machines.
So there is another claim, the idea of ballots smuggled in, and there were videos with ominous music of suitcases in different places with no reason whatsoever to believe that the suitcases contained fraudulent ballots. People have suitcases. It's not like a huge smoking gun in and of itself. And Trump was told, and yet he continued to repeat it. And then lastly, again, just as another example, we could do this all day, but I won't do it to you. The other claim was more votes than voters in Philadelphia. Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in general became a big focus because they stopped counting and then started again. Of course, if you understand the scheduling for vote counting in Philadelphia, you would know that they just have a schedule. They stop counting and then they start again the next morning. Not really evidence of anything, But the other claim was more votes than voters. And William Barr, Trump's own attorney general, says it's not true. There were not more votes than voters. And anybody just Googling Philadelphia, Pennsylvania population would be able to realize that.
I'd like to turn to President Trump's false allegations about election integrity in Philadelphia. The attorney general discussed these allegations at some length.
You know, the idea, the president has repeatedly suggested that there was some kind of outpouring of unexpected votes in inner city areas like Philadelphia as recently as January 13th when he walked off the NPR set. He was asked by the interviewer, what's your evidence of fraud? And he said, more people voted in Philadelphia than there were voters. And that was absolute rubbish.
Right.
The turnout in Philadelphia was in line with the state's turnout. And in fact, it was not as impressive as many suburban counties. And there was nothing strange about the Philadelphia turnout. It wasn't like there was all these unexpected votes that came out in Philadelphia. So,
right.
You know, I think once you actually look at the votes and then there's an obvious explanation. He, you know, for example, in Pennsylvania, Trump ran weaker than the Republican ticket generally. He ran weaker than two of the state candidates.
Anyway, the point is William Barr knows that it was all BS. So every single one of these claims, what do we know about them? We know two important things. One, there was not actually any evidence for them. But maybe even more importantly, two, there were Republicans around Trump who knew the claims were BS and would tell Trump that they were BS. And it did not matter. So a very critical moment in yesterday's Trump riot hearings. Last thing I want to look at on the Trump riot hearings day two before we go to a break. There are often stories that become stories for good reason. Like, for example, that Rudy Giuliani was appearing regularly drunk in different places and was giving people bad advice on the basis of being drunk. And whenever it would come up, and we've talked about it before, there were people on the right who would just deny it. And there would be some who would come out and say, you're making fun of alcoholism. And of course, we are not making fun of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a serious disease, very serious, horrible, horrible disease. The issue was whether there are people close to Donald Trump giving him advice who are not in a proper state of mind to be doing so. And it was widely reported that Rudy Giuliani was moved from appearing on TV at night to the morning with the idea that maybe he would not be drunk in those cases. And it was just a widely understood and reported thing. Well, yesterday's hearing started with Liz Cheney. One of the things that turned out in the investigation is that Rudy Giuliani was regularly drunk and giving Donald Trump advice. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, it sort of makes everything more logical because the storyline that Trump ultimately attached to makes a lot more sense if you say it's an inebriated person storyline. It's like, okay, well, that's so obvious that it sounds like what a drunk person would say happened at the election. Take a listen.
You will hear firsthand testimony that the president's campaign advisors urged him to await the counting of votes and not to declare victory on election night. The president understood even before the election that many more Biden voters had voted by mail because President Trump ignored the advice of his campaign experts and told his supporters only to vote in person. Donald Trump knew before the election that the counting of those mail-in ballots in several states would not begin until late in the day.
Correct.
And would not be complete for multiple days. This was expected, reported, and widely known. You will also hear testimony that President Trump rejected the advice of his campaign experts on election night and instead followed the course recommended by an apparently inebriated Rudy Giuliani to just claim he won and insist that the vote counting stop.
So one of the big questions and one of the big things that is fascistic and authoritarian is, just say you won. Just say you won is sort of the motto of this entire this entire farce, right? Just say you won. And that's what Trump did. He came out at 2-something in the morning on Election Day and said, I won. And we now have learned it was apparently the drunk idea of Rudy Giuliani. And of course, just as a reminder, many instances of Rudy apparently drunk. Here's one that we covered This was a 9/11 dinner where Rudy, not with it, Rudy.
Can you imagine that Tony Blinken or Miley? How's that guy a general? Jesus. The other day, he said that the Bagram Air Force Base is not strategically important. I wanted to grab his, what do you have, 5 stars, 10 stars, 12 stars? He has so many stars that come into his ears. I wanted to grab his stars, shove it down his throat, and say, it's 400 miles from China, ass. China is going to be our enemy for the next 40 years. You have an air base 400 miles from them, and you're giving it up, idiot.
Yeah, that may be the most drunk anyone has ever been at any kind of major speech. So every claim backed up by the investigation so far. Day three is today, and we will have more coverage tomorrow. Quick break, back after this. Find me on Twitter at @DPacman. Okay, let's do a little bit more coverage of yesterday's second day of the January 6th committee hearings. Another major and obvious scam that we all knew about, except, of course, for the millions of Trumpists who donated to it, is that this so-called Trump official election defense fund, which was going to fund recounts and lawsuits and audits and all these different things, it was a scam. It was a grift. It was, if you looked at the fine print, obviously another attempt for Trump to enrich himself by raising money and then enrich his friends and family by hiring friends and family and paying them out of those donated funds. Well, it's another thing we suspected, which the January 6th committee has now apparently confirmed to be true. We have a video from yesterday's hearing where Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren explains that the Trump official election defense fund didn't actually exist. It was yet another Trump grift. And again, a grift which victimizes his supporters. Progressives were not donating to Trump's election defense fund. It is a grift of his own supporters.
I'm senior investigative counsel with the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to Trump supporters,
yes,
sometimes as many as 25 a day. The emails claimed the, quote, left-wing mob was undermining the election, implored supporters to, quote, step up to protect the integrity of the election, and encouraged them to, quote, fight back. But as the Select Committee has demonstrated, the Trump campaign knew these claims of voter fraud were false, yet they continued to barrage small dollar donors with emails encouraging them to donate to something called the Official Election Defense Fund. The Select Committee discovered no such fund existed.
I don't believe there is actually a fund called the Election Defense Fund.
Is it fair to say the Election Defense Fund was another, as I think we've called it, a marketing tactic?
Yes.
And tell us about these funds as marketing tactics.
Just the topic matter, where money could potentially go to be, how money could potentially be used.
The claims that the election was stolen were so successful, President Trump and his allies raised $250
million. $250
million.
Remember, when I brought the story of the grift to you, only about $70 million had been raised. And then, okay, we figured out it's another grift. I wasn't going to keep updating you about the amount of money. By the time it was all said and done, $250 million had been raised. And it's a grift all the way down. As an example of how the grift was even further used for enriching Trump's friends and family, Kimberly Guilfoyle, the then girlfriend, maybe now fiance or wife, I don't know, of Don Jr., she spoke for 2.5 minutes at the rally on January 6th. She was reportedly paid $60,000 for that speech. And that is the money that came from the so-called Election Defense Fund, which it's sort of like if I were to say, hey, please donate to the Democracy Defense Fund at the David Pakman Show. If you're just making a donation to the David Pakman Show, just because I call it something doesn't mean it exists and it doesn't mean it's being used for that. Like, it just gets mixed in with the money that comes in for memberships and whatever else. Just because you put on an email, official election defense fund, doesn't mean it's a real thing. And this was so obvious that it was going on that the sad part is it's news to people. And many of the small donors who got grifted and scammed are never going to know it. Now, is it a crime? That's a great question. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren was asked, is that a crime? And she said it's for someone else to decide.
We're a legislative committee, and it's clear that he intentionally misled his donors, asked them to donate to a fund that didn't exist, and used the money raised for something other than what he said.
Yep.
Now, it's for someone else to decide whether that's criminal or not. That's not the purview of a legislative committee.
Yes, and Merrick Garland, Attorney General, said they are certainly watching the hearings at the Justice Department, but who knows what the outcome will be. Another scam, another grift, not a surprise to viewers and listeners of this show. I have some fascinating audio and video to play for you. In the midst of the January 6th committee hearings, Rudy Giuliani said on his podcast, which was released right as the House committee was holding its hearings, Rudy puts out a podcast and he says, he admits to the entire thing. He says the whole point of the rally on January 6th and of subsequently going down to the Capitol, the point of it, the goal of it, the objective, was to try to get electoral votes that Donald Trump didn't actually earn. Listen to the language Rudy uses here, okay? You really have to, this is one of those, it's linguistically important to listen to the words used.
When the president put out the first notice of this rally, which actually was somewhere in mid-December, mm-hmm. for a January 6th rally, on the day that the Electoral College vote was going to be taken, the whole purpose of it was a rally in support of the president's bid for electoral votes, in the sense that he had proven and shown that he had really won these states and he was being deprived of these states unfairly and illegally.
A bid. The point of the rally was to support Trump's bid for electoral votes. You don't bid for electoral votes. You either won them or you didn't. And it is really, I know the Eggman's going to write in about it, it's Kafka-esque language. You don't make a bid for electoral votes. You don't make a case for electoral votes. You don't argue about electoral votes. You don't rally. You either win them or you don't. How can a rally of people saying things be an argument for electoral votes? You either won them or you didn't. And if you think that something was wrong, you fight it in court. That's the venue where you fight it, where Trump tried to fight it. And I believe it was 68 cases, 63 or 68 cases that he lost. That's the one venue where you argue for electoral votes. And it's an admission that the whole point of what happened on January 6th was try to get votes you didn't actually win. End of story, case in point, and Rudy Giuliani admitting to the entire thing. All right, one more story before we move on to other things, sort of in this world of election fraud and claims and riots and all these different things. Former White House counsel Norm Eisen is now saying that he believes Trump is likely to be prosecuted in Georgia. And this, I got a bunch of emails about this. This is sort of separate from the Trump riot hearings. This is specifically in the state of Georgia. Business Insider reporting. Former White House special counsel says Trump is likely to be prosecuted in Georgia because of particularly strong evidence. Former President Donald Trump could be prosecuted in Georgia for his attempts to overturn the state's election results in 2020. Norm Eisen, former White House special counsel for ethics, told CNN, it's likely Trump will be prosecuted because of particularly strong evidence. Quote, I think the evidence is particularly strong for a prosecution in the state of Georgia, where the Atlanta DA has convened a special grand jury. Remember that that's where Fulton County DA Fannie Willis wanted a special grand jury to look at Trump's attempts to overturn the election there. The grand jury was convened last month. You have to recall that this is the state in which Trump wanted those 11,780 votes that he didn't earn.
I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
And that is very, very strong evidence. It's a clear attempt to extort. This was after the third recount in December of 2020, which confirmed again Joe Biden won Georgia. You might remember that Georgia took a while to flip to blue on the map that most media outlets were using because it was being challenged in a more real way than what was being done in other states. Joe Biden won it. And Donald Trump is on a recording after we knew that he had lost, saying, find me the votes, saying there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, you've recalculated. And look, it turns out that Donald Trump actually won. And remember that when the Georgia Secretary of State wouldn't go with it, and I don't believe that the Georgia Secretary of State is great in any way, but he was unwilling to go with it. Donald Trump then started the mob boss type underhanded threats. Listen, this is going to be costly in many ways, Trump said. Costly in many ways. It is straight up mob vocabulary, and he's recorded doing it. So the question now, this is parallel to the January 6th investigation. Is there going to be an indictment? Are there going to be charges coming out of Georgia? And I know, listen, I'm with everybody. Even if you get charges, it doesn't necessarily mean anything major is going to happen. But charging a former president is a really big deal. Just there being charges would be a major, major deal. We will have all of these clips on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Bottom line it for me. At the end of the day, where are you right now? Does Trump get charged anywhere? Federally, Georgia, Pennsylvania, just any, will there be any charges against Trump or not? Let me know your thoughts in a comment, in a tweet, in an email to info@davidpakman.com. Today, we're going to be speaking with Sheila Heen, who's a Harvard Law School professor, founder of Triad Consulting, and also co-author of the New York Times bestsellers Difficult Conversations, as well as Thanks for the Feedback. Sheila, it's really great to have you on today.
I'm delighted to be here.
So every week I get questions from people in my audience. I have this very big political disagreement with my mom, and I want to know how to handle it. Or I have this difficult situation with my coworkers politically, and I want to know how to handle it. And people ask me for advice. And one of the first things I say is, well, to figure out the right path forward, you kind of first have to think about what you want the outcome to be. In other words, in a political disagreement with your mom, what's more important, proving her wrong or maintaining a relationship with your mom, for example, depending on what you expect might happen. So can you kind of open up by giving us a basic framework in terms of how to think generally about some of these difficult conversations that people sometimes have?
Absolutely. And David, I think you're right on the money, meaning I think one of the core questions is, what is my purpose in having a conversation? Because if my purpose is to prove her wrong, that is not necessarily going to change her mind. You may have noticed that.
True.
Right? Because it's totally clear to you that you have proven her wrong, and yet her views persist.
Right.
And so I think that's part of the struggle, which is that I actually think that there are things that are hard about just being in relationship with someone who holds a view that you find incredibly disturbing, upsetting, wrongheaded, foolish, uninformed. Should we keep going? What
right.
would you add?
All those things. Yeah, right, right. And it's important also because there's a range of, the example I give often is when people say, are you friends with like radical right people, for example? I'll say, listen, if someone thinks the tax rate should be 2 points lower than I do, it's not a big deal. It's just a disagreement, and we can kind of just work through that. It's not really going to affect too many things about my ability to relate to them. If they believe there's a secret cabal of Jews controlling every aspect of, you know, that's going to be a little bit different in terms of our ability to relate to each other. So it seems like that context is important too.
I think that that's exactly right. And so I think what we're talking about are views that feel like they hit at the core of who we are.
Yes.
Or that suggest a threat to something that we hold really dear. And so in this weird way, there's like an identity issue that comes with like, how could I, being who I am and what I care about and what I want people to see about who I am, and respect about who I am, how could I be fill in the blank, friends with, family with, neighbors with, coworkers with this person who at least the caricature of the view that they hold in some way invalidates, dismisses, or oppresses something that really matters to me about who I am. And just that that identity quake that comes with that question, I think, is why we feel like we need to have a conversation with them.
Right. And what would thinking of techniques, you know, sometimes it'll be like, hey, we need to talk, or you said something that really offended me, starting with how yes. one felt. There's all these different tactics that are often mentioned. Is there some universal best way to kind of start some of these conversations, or does it really depend on who the person is and what you're going to talk about?
So I think that the thing that it depends most on is negotiating with yourself about your purpose.
Yeah.
So, for instance, the couple of examples that you just gave, if they just said something or did something that I want to raise, well, then there is a purpose to the conversation. And my purpose would be, I want to share with you sort of what impact that had for me, or why I found it upsetting or frustrating, or that you're not really understanding something that feels important to me for you to understand.
Right.
So my purpose is actually to share something with you and to feel heard. Well, that's a purpose that I might be able to achieve. Right.
Right.
And if I've got my purpose aligned with something that feels realistic, well, then I can start by just sharing that purpose. Like, hey, whether or not you agree, I want you to understand why this matters to me. That would be a great purpose. And depending on the relationship, they may or may not say like, okay, or they may start explaining why you're wrong.
Right. Yeah. You know, when I spoke to, once I spoke to someone who has hired and fired lots of people, and I think this will be kind of parallel to what we're talking about. And he said one of the things he doesn't like, which he did early in his career when he would have to fire someone, is he would bring them in and he would go, listen, so I want to talk because things haven't been going so well lately. And then the employee might say, they haven't. I think things have been going fine. You're already yeah. derailed, right? And you're kind of trying to back up. And so his thing was, he would go, listen, thanks for meeting with me. We're going to have to let you go. Let me explain to you why. And then you're putting out front that there's a decision and there's a reality here. And now it's just a matter of kind of thinking it through and talking it through. Is that, where does that fit into the techniques that you think can be useful? And is there something about that to, instead of, listen, remember the other day when we were talking about, it's like, no, I don't remember that. Just saying, we had a conversation that left me feeling really upset with you, and I want to tell you what happened. Is there something about that as a technique?
Totally, totally. So one of the things that you're describing is what we would call a bad news conversation.
Mm.
Like there's something that has been decided, or there's something that matters to me. And the purpose of this conversation is partly to let you know that.
Yeah.
And if the purpose of the conversation is to let you know that, then I need to put the bad news up front. And what's funny is that if you ask people, if somebody has bad news for you or needs to tell you something important, what are your requests of them?
Yeah.
Almost everybody says, like, just tell me up front, like, don't tiptoe into it or hide the ball or make me guess. But then when we're on the other side of the conversation, we ease into it. I've watched someone try to fire someone by asking them questions.
Right.
But don't you think you'd be better off, you know, at a different organization?
And right. it's not like really,
because
no, yeah.
it was a friend of theirs, right? So we do it because of some of the identity stuff that I was talking about. Like, I'm not the kind of person who hurts people's feelings. I'm not the kind of person who treats someone unfairly. And that's why a lot of getting ready to have a important conversation means negotiating with yourself. Like, well, what's true? You might hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
What's true? Maybe you are sensitive and maybe that's okay. So, and you need to let them know, like, look, this is just a topic on which I am sensitive.
Yeah.
We don't have to argue about whether I'm normal sensitive or oversensitive or you're insensitive. But if we're going to be in a relationship with each other, this is where we're at.
One of the other situations that often comes up in the political space, and this is less about people in my audience, but more about some of the people that I talk about, politicians or public figures, is yeah. allegations are often made against people of all different kinds. And then often there's like an instant evaluation of how an individual reacts when accused of something. And unfortunately, what can be difficult about it is, no matter how you react, it's sort of seen as though, like, of course, that's what's being said, you know, and whether the allegation is of some kind of criminality. We've seen this in the context of the Me Too movement, you know, all sorts of allegations. And if people say, I absolutely didn't do that, the reaction can often be, well, that's what everybody would say, at least initially. Right. Or most people would. Or, you kind of get the idea. When there are accusations being hurled at you, what are some of the ways that are better to respond, maybe, than what we often see?
Well, so I'll give an answer that I actually learned from someone else. So years ago, we were doing a program in collaboration with another group, and the other group included people who did internal investigations within the CIA, FBI, et cetera. And so what they were teaching was how to read signals that someone might not be giving you the straight story.
Yep.
So one of the things that I learned from them is that one of the most common red flags is what's called a protest answer.
Mm.
So if you accuse me of fill in the blank, rather than saying, I absolutely did not do that, the person says, I can't even believe you would ask me that.
Mm.
I can't even believe you would have the nerve to, et cetera, et cetera. So what's interesting is not that if I'm a truthful person and I didn't do what's being accused, that I wouldn't be horrified that you're even asking or suspecting me. But what they would say is, if you are innocent and telling the truth is your friend. So the first thing you're going to blurt out is the truth, which is like, of course not. Then you can add, I can't even believe you're asking me that. So what's interesting is that you feel, if you're on the being accused side of it, you feel both things. And it can be tempting to think like, I shouldn't even have to say I didn't do it. But do say that you didn't do it.
Right. So like a reaction like, why would I do that? That might be where we say, well, you're not really denying it. I mean, is that sort of the...
Right, that's the non-responsive to the question.
Yeah.
The other observation that I learned from them was that the biggest mistake we make if we suspect something is going on is that we don't ask the direct question.
Right.
And they're like, just ask the direct question and get a direct answer one way or another. And it's not that that proves anything, like you can't be a human lie detector, but it's at least a flag to say like, you might want to look into it a little bit more.
Yeah. In police interviewing techniques, which I've read about a bit, one of the things that's often said, and you know, whether these things are always true or mostly true, I guess it depends on circumstances, but it's when you're interviewing a truly innocent suspect, they will typically get really mad as you continue to imply or suggest that they did something. They will genuinely get mad that they are being accused of this. Whereas guilty people will do some of the things you're saying or kind of react in other ways, because it's genuinely infuriating to be accused of something that you just didn't do.
Yeah. So I think that's really important, which is, it's not that you don't feel the fury or the indignance. So being transparent about that, even as you are simultaneously being transparent about what is not true.
Right.
Let me also say, David, that this is related to most difficult conversations, because we're often having the conversation because something is wrong.
Yeah.
Right. Something has gone wrong. Somebody screwed something up. Somebody did or said something that's a problem. And blame is a feature of most of those conversations. If it's not explicit, it's implicit. Like, you know, we need to talk about the fact that you don't seem to know how to run Zoom
right.
or use your microphone. What is wrong with you? And if the purpose of the conversation is actually to fix the problem, blame is often not helpful.
Mm.
Because it's basically saying, let's talk about why you're the problem here. I'm the good guy and the victim, and you are the person who screwed it up and is incompetent.
Right.
And it's not surprising that not many people really want to be part of that conversation. Like, no, thank you. I don't want to be in that play with that being cast in that role. So part of what we talk about, if you're actually trying to problem solve, is shifting to talking about joint contribution. Like, what did we each do or fail to do that got us where we're at? Because that'll tell us what we need to change if we're going to fix the problem and not have it reoccur, right? Or be in the same place next week. That's a little bit different than the political situations that you're talking about, because they're not actually trying to solve a problem.
No, it's usually about trying to appear as though you got one over on whoever else you're speaking to or whatever the case may be. And that's really at cross purposes with much of the productive ways to have these conversations. I mean, it's interesting because 80% of political speech in the United States is sort of structurally not even designed to achieve anything.
Well, what it's structurally designed to achieve is not a conversation with the other side.
Right.
It's a conversation with your base, right?
Yes.
So you are saying it because you think it is going to persuade or influence someone or something. It's just not what we're pretending it is across the aisle or across party lines.
When it comes to when you're in the middle of some kind of tense exchange, and this could be a debate I'm having on my show with someone who disagrees with me, or someone talking to their mom about whatever they said, or, you know, whatever the case may be, oftentimes there's this the emotion kind of blocks your ability to really think. And then after the fact, you often say, I knew so many other things that I could have said, but I didn't say, etc. How can you stay kind of level headed during these exchanges?
Well, so I would distinguish between being emotional and sharing emotion.
Mm.
Because I would argue that you, in those exchanges, you've actually got two layers of things going on. One is the debate that we're trying to have, or the issues that we're trying to, what, get one over on, persuade yeah. members you're right, or just better understand. And sure. so part of the advice is shift your purpose to, can we understand why we see this differently? If we can shift from proving that I'm right to, it seems so obvious that I'm right, I'm just trying to understand why we see it differently. That's actually a productive conversation. But you've got a second layer going on under the surface, which is the emotions and relationship layer that is all about how I feel treated in this exchange.
Yeah, one tool along those lines that I've been told by a couple of different people is it can be useful to say, okay, let's say the topic is abortion. I'm pro-choice. I'm talking to someone who's against abortion. Ask the other person why they believe you are pro-choice, to even see if they understand, even if they disagree with your framework, how you came to the conclusion. And that, number one, it's good for everybody to have the knowledge, but just the exercise of it might put the person in a position that where they, just by even saying it, they might at least be more willing to understand your view, if not agree with it.
I think that that's right. And what it highlights is that in any really good conversation, or attempt to influence, by the way, you need two things. You need high quality assertion, like that you share your view with clarity and thoughtfulness and et cetera. But you also actually need high quality empathy.
Mm.
That you are really listening generously and deeply to each other, to not to because I think I'm going to agree with you, but because in order to understand what might be persuasive to you, I actually have to understand what you think and why you think it.
Yes.
And then I can say, well, so here's what it feels like is left out of your view, or that I worry about, that it sounds like you're not so worried about. So talk to me about that. So when we talk about high quality assertion, it actually has to be rooted in deep empathy and generous listening. So the move that you just suggested is a clever move, although it's basically backing the other person into a corner to say, be empathetic to me first.
Right.
And some people will take that and say, like, yeah, no, I actually think I can articulate your view, and that's helpful. But if that doesn't work, it may be because you actually have to do it first.
Right.
That you need to say, so let me see if I can describe what you're saying and why you think what you think or feel the way that you feel. And then you can tell me what's left out of that. And then once they feel like you really get it, their view, then you're in a great position to basically say, like, okay, so let me say a little bit about why I see this differently. And I would love it if you could see if you can summarize it back to me, because this is just a complicated issue.
Right.
And that sense of reciprocity, which is one of the most robust findings in the literature. Like, if you attack me, I'm going to attack you back. But if you're willing to listen to me and consider genuinely, authentically, why I think what I think or feel how I feel, well, then I almost feel an obligation to do the same for you.
Right. So that would be like with the abortion example, it might be, hey, listen, my belief is you're against it because you believe life starts at conception, so that any abortion is like a murder. And but can you give me a sense of why you think I am pro-choice? And so I'm kind of doing it first, in a sense.
Yes, you can. Or you might even tweak the question to say, can you give me a sense? And that's a genuine, can you, or do you feel like you need more context from me in order to understand that? Right.
Right.
Because there's the, there's the general view of why people are on each side of this issue, but then there's the you view. Like, why do you, David, care about this?
Right.
And often around these really important hot issues, political issues, one of the things that I hear is just differences in what people worry most about.
Mm.
So someone who is pro-life worries most about the life of the child. They would say child.
Sure.
And murder. Someone who is pro-choice worries most about other people making choices for individuals. And what's interesting is that if we take a couple steps back politically, Republicans often worry most about individual choice and government interference in individual choices, which, of course, in abortion, that's flipped.
Yes.
Whereas Democrats often worry most about the voices of those who are oppressed and not in the majority, right, and equity, right? Or fairness. And so often one of the ears I have on the conversation is, whatever it is we're talking about, what is it that each of us is worried most about?
Mm.
And in some ways, I don't have to worry about what you're worried about because I know that you'll take care of it.
Right.
If there wasn't anybody protecting individual autonomy or choice from government, I would have to worry about it, but I can rely on you guys to worry about it. So I can worry about something else that actually matters to us as a society as well.
Super interesting. We've been speaking with Harvard Law School professor Sheila Heen, co-author of the New York Times bestsellers Difficult Conversations, as well as Thanks for the Feedback. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As you might have heard, there are people peacefully protesting at the Supreme Court. Now, when I use the term peacefully protesting, I actually mean it. I'm not referring to the Trump riots of January 6th, which were extraordinarily violent and criminal, and saying it was a peaceful protest. I'm actually talking about just peaceful protests protected by the First Amendment, with permits, even permits for the speech. And yesterday, Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis was in New York, and he said that those protesters at the Supreme Court are engaging in an insurrection. And this is something we've seen many times from Republicans. When they do a thing, they start saying it is the left who is actually doing that thing. When a word starts to be part of the milieu, they start to use the word and try to redefine it or change it, which is funny because it's what they accuse the left of doing. Oh, the left is trying to redefine woman. The left is trying to read this. Right. But now you're saying that just a protest is an insurrection because you don't like the fact that your side did a horrible, riotous insurrection attempt on January 6th of 2021. So let's look at what Ron DeSantis said. Not sounding, I will say, like the biggest supporter of the First Amendment here.
What they're trying to bring is attention to the fact that the Supreme Court may overturn Roe v. Wade later today, or then again, the coverage could come out next week when they ultimately do issue their opinion.
Well, I think that we have a rule of law in this country, and you don't get to just have a mob descend on a Supreme Court justice's house or try to impede the operations of government because there may be a decision you don't like. That would be considered an insurrection, to stop a court from functioning. And yet they seem to be able to get away with a lot more than if the shoe were on the other foot. So,
okay, so listen, we have to break these things down one by one. First and foremost, the armed person who went to Kavanaugh's house, absolutely outrageous, seemingly criminal, arrest him, charge him, throw the book at him 100%. In terms of the protests in general at the judges, at the justices' houses, I've already said it is for law enforcement and the Justice Department to figure out when is it legal and when is it not. There are elements of that that are absolutely protected by free speech. And there are elements of it that may go over, and it has to do with the specifics of where the protest is taking place, etc. But the protesters at the Supreme Court are not trying to shut down the Supreme Court. They are making their voices heard, and it is a permitted peaceful protest, a real permitted peaceful protest, unlike what happened on January 6th. And think of the absurdity, right? I mean, on the one hand, they want us to believe January 6th was fine, despite the fact that there was violence, there were people entering the building, there were people chanting to hang the vice president, there were people stealing stuff, there were people breaking windows. that was nothing. That was fine. It was peaceful. It was tourists. It was whatever. On the other hand, the current Supreme Court protests, no violence. They have permits. They're not entering the building. They're not chanting to hang anyone. They're not stealing stuff. They're not breaking windows. That we're supposed to believe is an insurrection. And of course, hopefully the interviewer would point that out and ask a follow-up question. But at the end of the day, it is Fox News. By the way, they haven't even built gallows to hang anyone at the Supreme Court protests, which is an interesting, notable thing. So the real concern here is, I mean, listen, DeSantis is a clown, but the real concern is if these people get power back in November in the House and or Senate, which they may, if DeSantis becomes the next president, I mean, I know it's early, but he's doing really well in 2024 primary polling and he's not even running. And he's less incompetent than Trump. It's not inconceivable that he could become president. If these people get power and they may get it back soon, what does it actually mean for peace, for real peaceful protest? What does it mean for criticism of the government or whatever the case may be? Extraordinarily scary and dystopian stuff. So you all know I like a good conspiracy theory, not just because, I don't know, sometimes they're entertaining, but the way people come to believe things is very interesting, but also the sort of suspensions of disbelief, the lack of skepticism that sometimes goes with some conspiracy theories is also really interesting. And I don't know if it has to do with the sort of commitment and desperation to believe something or what, but we're going to look at an example here. Our friends over at The Good Liars, in fact, Jason from The Good Liars, spoke to a guy who believes that John F. Kennedy is still alive and currently president of the United States. Now, we're going to play the clip. Some of you may remember the JFK stuff has actually been sort of prominent over the last couple of years. And one of the really funny things is there's lots of people who have bought into the JFK conspiracy theories, but they're a little bit confused about John F. Kennedy, the guy who was president, versus John F. Kennedy Jr. And there's this really funny clip I played for you a few months ago of protesters saying JFK is the president. And then they go, wait, do you mean JFK Jr.? And they go, yeah, no, they're like arguing with each other as to which one it is because they don't really remember. OK, so that's the setup. Here's another guy who says right now JFK is the president and JFK Jr. is the vice president, which is a new spin on this one.
Explain the shirt to us.
Donald Trump, John F. Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy Jr.
He's vice president.
He's the vice president.
Kennedy is our president.
So you got to explain this. You got to explain this to me. So John F. Kennedy Sr. is president right now?
Senior's president right now, yes.
You're being serious right now?
I'm being serious.
And but didn't he, because remember in Dallas, he was riding and then somebody shot and his brains went all over Jackie O.
Yeah, something like that.
But you're saying that didn't happen.
Right, but that didn't happen. So the reason I love this one is there's two layers. It's not new that people sometimes claim John F. Kennedy wasn't really killed, right? In 1963 in Dallas, it just didn't happen that way. And in fact, there's actually more than that. He was killed, but not by Lee Harvey Oswald, or not only by Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, so that's like one set of things. Then you go to he wasn't actually killed at all. And okay, but like imagine that he hadn't been killed at all. But then there's the wackiest part, which is John F. Kennedy would be 105 years old right now. And that's where it actually starts to get funny, because many of these people are confused about JFK versus JFK Jr. JFK, if he were still alive today, would be 62 years old. I'm sorry, JFK Jr. John F. Kennedy would be 105 years old today if he were still alive. So if you can get beyond he wasn't really assassinated, which already takes a lot, anything involving John F. Kennedy Sr. today, you're talking about a man who would be 105 years old. And that particular element seems to be completely missing from the critical thinking of these individuals. Now, beyond that kind of funny thing, I don't really know why the JFK stuff has seen a resurgence in the last year and a half as related to Donald Trump. And I mean, I'm open to hearing from people why you think that. We've seen all sorts of conspiracy theories relating to Trump, like Trump is truly still the president. The military is still under the control of Donald Trump. There's a shadow government, whatever. Right. OK, fine. But Trump's in his mid 70s, so it's plausible. Why all of a sudden shifting to the would be now 105 year old John F. Kennedy? It doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe it's just things go in cycles and we're back to JFK one way or another. Maybe it'll happen again when JFK would have been 120 years old in 15 years. I don't know. But let me know your thoughts as to why the JFK stuff is such a big deal to so many of these Trump people. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. As many of you know, I will sometimes use the phrase, if all you have is a hammer, right? If all you have is a hammer.
We're doing a class action lawsuit against all machines.
No, no, I don't know that I would call a hammer a machine. I would call it a tool. If all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you are obsessed with vaccine conspiracy theories, then anytime anything happens to anyone, you point to vaccines. Our old friend Eric from Mass called in about Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber's recent health troubles. What do you think he blames for them? Take a listen.
Hey, David, it's Eric from Mass. What do you think of Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber both getting vaccine injured? Paralysis of the face, stroke and a clot to Hailey, paralysis of the face for Bieber. It's all listed there. It's from the vaccine. That's a fact. There's no disputing that. Good luck with your kid on the way. That sounds great. Too bad you won't have the same income with the site, and you'll have to find another way. But if you're a resourceful guy, I'm sure you'll be all right.
Yep. No, I'm going to be doing, I don't know how many of you know about Barista Fire. It's quite a movement. And I'm really, the real reason I've had my espresso machine is I'm going to be moving into a second job of making coffee very, very soon. Okay, so listen. Justin Bieber has been diagnosed with something called Ramsey-Hunt syndrome. It happens with it's basically shingles based. We don't have to go into detail, but it's when a shingles outbreak. Shingles is related to chickenpox, right? It's when a shingles outbreak affects the facial nerve. OK, it has nothing to do with the vaccine whatsoever. I don't even know if Justin Bieber's vaccinated, quite frankly. Hailey Bieber, Justin Bieber's wife, did have a small stroke recently. Again, no idea whether she's vaccinated and no evidence whatsoever that it has anything to do with the vaccine. And remember, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When Bob Saget died of blunt force trauma to the head, Candace Owens said, this is a vaccine death, and blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, the autopsy came out and it was not. Sometimes people, you know, I've told the story. Of my late cousin, Fabian Bielinski, a well-known Argentinian movie director of Nine Queens fame and many other great films. When he was in his mid-40s, he went to Brazil for a production and he had a heart attack and died. And sometimes these things happen. And if you want to just blame everything on vaccines that someone may or may not have received, you certainly can do it. But I prefer to stay in the world of evidence and reality. That's just me. You do you, Eric from Mass. On today's bonus show, I will describe to you the insanity of my last 8 days on planet Earth. Yeah, it's crazy. We will also talk about the massive dumping of the stock market and crypto and the bear market and everything that's going on. Is a recession coming? You know, I don't make predictions, but it's a question people are asking. I don't make predictions. I'm not going to tease that I'm going to predict on the bonus show. Oh, the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money.
Yeah.
Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
I'm not going to predict that. I'm not going to make any predictions, but I will promise a good time on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Take pleasure in my misery that I will describe to you from the last 8 days of dealing with a newborn. All of that and more when producer Pat joins me.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Jobs are back, but prices are still too high. COVID is down, but gas prices are up. Our work isn't done.
President Biden blames Republicans for blocking his plan to fight inflation in a major address on the economy and labor rights at the AFL-CIO convention in Philadelphia. We'll get an update from longtime labor journalist Stephen Greenhouse at the convention, author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Then, the White House has announced Biden will visit Saudi Arabia next month in a dramatic reversal from Biden's promises on the campaign trail.
And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
But first, we'll speak with journalist Garrett Graff, author of Watergate, A New History.
I'll be talking today about the historical parallels of Richard Nixon's scandal, which marks the 50th anniversary this week of the Watergate burglary on June 17, 1972, and the modern investigation by the U.S. House into the events of January 6th and the differences politically then and now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters went to the polls Tuesday in five states. Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina all held primaries. A special House election also took place in Texas. In South Carolina, five-term Republican Congressmember Tom Rice was soundly defeated in his Republican primary. Rice was one of just 10 Republicans who'd voted to impeach Donald Trump last year after the January 6th insurrection. Another Republican incumbent in South Carolina, Nancy Mace, survived a primary challenge from a Trump-backed candidate. But last year, Mace, though she criticized Trump after the insurrection, later campaigned in the primary on a pro-Trump message. She even recorded a campaign video outside Trump Tower in February. Meanwhile, in Nevada, Republicans who supported Trump's coup attempt won the primaries for Senate and Secretary of State. With his victory in Nevada's Republican Senate primary, Adam Laxalt will now face Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in a race that could determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Laxalt co-chaired Trump's 2020 campaign in Nevada and led efforts to overturn Joe Biden's election win in the state. Meanwhile, Republicans in Nevada picked Jim Marchant to be their candidate for Secretary of State. He's an election denier who was urged to run for office by a prominent backer of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Marchant is leader of an alliance known as America First, which helps backers of Trump's coup attempt to run for top election offices. According to the Washington Post, more than 100 Republicans who backed Trump's election fraud claims have already won primaries this year. In another closely watched race, Republican Myra Flores won a special election for an open House seat in South Texas, which had been held by a Democrat for the past 10 years. Flores, who was born in Mexico and is married to a Border Patrol agent, outspent her closest Democratic rival by a margin of 16 to 1. House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection appears divided on whether the panel should make criminal referrals of Donald Trump or anyone else to the Justice Department. On Monday, the committee's chair, Benny Thompson,